Chapter 4. Darwin's Beaks. What a trifling difference must often determine which shall survive and which perish. Charles Darwin, Letter to Asa Gray. When Darwin was a student there, Christ's College was known as the School of John Milton and the Reverend William Paley. Paley was required reading for a B.A., and Darwin read him over and over, charmed and convinced by the long line of argumentation. In fact, Paley's Evidences of Christianity and Natural Theology gave Darwin as much delight as did Euclid. Natural theology, or evidences of the existence and attributes of the deity collected from the appearances of nature, had been a bestseller when it was first published in 1802. The book's first lines are sometimes quoted even today. In crossing a heath, suppose I against a stone, and were asked how the stone came to be there, Paley begins. I might possibly answer that, for anything I knew to the contrary, it had lain there forever. Nor would it perhaps be very easy to show the absurdity of this answer. But suppose I had found a watch upon the ground. A watch would require more explanation than a stone. A watch, says Paley, implies a watchmaker. Someone had to invent it. Someone had to put it together. And if that is true of a watch, Paley asks, how much more so of the living things we find on the heath? Even the simplest working parts of the smallest plants and animals go so far beyond our mortal powers of artifice that they imply an artificer of artificers, a creator of creators, a god. That was the world view of both Darwin and Fitzroy while they were standing on the black lava of the Galapagos, where a live bird looks almost as surreal as a watch on a heath. And afterward, that is how Fitzroy remembered the beaks of the Galapagos finches. All the small birds that live on these lava-covered islands have short beaks, very thick at the base, like that of a bullfinch, Fitzroy writes in his Beagle Memoirs, 3 volumes, with Darwin's memoir tacked on as a 4th. Fitzroy is mistaken, of course. His description fits only 1 out of the 13 Galapagos finches, the heavy-duty lineman's pliers of Magnirostris. But in any case, such a powerful beak, Fitzroy goes on to suggest, must be perfect for hunting and pecking on iron-hard lava and crushing berries for their juice. This appears to be one of those admirable provisions of infinite wisdom by which each created thing is adapted to the place for which it was intended. Darwinism is often spurned by the devout as a branch or prop of atheism. Yet Paley inspired Darwin at least as much as he inspired Fitzroy. And it was precisely this tradition of natural theology that led Darwin to the most original and unconventional step in his argument, his theory of the importance of variations. If living things are well made, Darwin argued, if they are admirably adapted to their places in nature, contrivances more elaborate than watches, then even the slightest variations must make a difference to the individual animals and plants that are saddled with them. Some variations must help living things run better, some worse, and some, a very few variations arising only once in thousands of generations, might help them fit into an entirely new spot in the economy of nature. The beak of a bird makes a natural test of this step in Darwin's argument, not only because the beak is so easy to measure, but because it is so obviously vital to the life of the bird. Darwin's finches can't put food in their mouths with their wings. They can't use their claws either, any more than we can dine comfortably with our feet. They have to use their beaks. Beaks are to birds what hands are to us. They are the bird's chief tools for handling, managing, and manipulating the things of this world. Manus meaning hand. The shape of a bird's beak sets tight limits on what it can eat. Although the bones and the horny sheaths of the mandibles are a little more flexible than they look, a woodcock can poke deep down into the mud, part its beak at the very tip, and grab an earthworm. Still, these are not many-jointed and articulate instruments like our hands. Each beak is a hand with a single permanent gesture. It is a general-purpose tool that can serve only a limited number of purposes. Woodpeckers have chisels. Egrets have spears. Darters have swords. Herons and bitterns have tongs. Hawks, falcons, and eagles have hooks. Curlews have pincers. There are about 9,000 species of birds alive in the world today, and the variety of their beaks helped confirm Paley's belief in an inventive God. Flamingos' beaks have deep troughs and fine filters through which the birds pump water and mud with their tongues. Kingfishers' beaks have such stout inner braces and struts that a few species can dig tunnels in riverbanks by sailing headlong into the earth over and over again like flying jackhammers. Some finch beaks are like carpentry shops. They come equipped with ridges inside the upper mandible, which serve as a sort of built-in vise and help the finch hold a seed in place while sawing it open with the lower mandible. But plain or fancy, each beak can only do so much. The flamingo's beak is good for filtering pond water. The hawk's is good for ripping up a rabbit, a fox, or another bird. If the flamingo and the hawk ever tried to trade jobs, the hawk would drown in the pond scum, and the flamingo would get its eyes poked out. Darwin extrapolates from big variations like these to the much smaller variations between individuals. According to his theory, even the slightest idiosyncrasies in the shape of an individual beak can sometimes make a difference in what that particular bird can eat. In this way, the variation will matter to the bird its whole life, most of which, when it is not asleep, it spends eating. The shape of its particular beak will either help it live a little longer or cut its life a little shorter, so that, in Darwin's words, the smallest grain in the balance in the long run must tell on which death shall fall and which shall survive. None of Darwin's readers doubted that the hooks, swords, spears, and pincers of the world's birds are of adaptive value. That was the pious, conventional, and common-sense view of Paley. But many readers did doubt that individual variations mean as much as Darwin says. He himself never actually saw a slight variation help or hurt the chances of an animal or plant in its struggle to survive. Darwin does give one passage in The Origin, the promising heading, Illustrations of the Action of Natural Selection. In order to make it clear how, as I believe, natural selection acts, this passage begins, I must beg permission to give one or two imaginary illustrations. Let us take the case of the wolf. Then he gives a few quick sketches to show that, hypothetically, in a hard winter, when there is almost nothing else for a wolf to eat but deer, the fleetest and slimmest wolves would be expected to do best. Darwin makes similar arguments about nectar-bearing flowers and honeybees, all logical and hypothetical. That is the end of the section. These sketches are so vivid that they enter straight into the minds of Darwin's readers. For years, those who accepted and those who rejected them felt no compelling need to go beyond them, and certainly not Darwin's bulldog Huxley. But the question now is, does selection take place in nature? He asks rhetorically in one of his defenses of Darwinism. Is there anything like the operation of man in exercising selective breeding taking place in nature? In answer, he asks us to imagine what it must be like for a species of animal in nature, surrounded by 50 or 100 others, with multitudinous animals which prey upon it, and which are its direct opponents, and others preying on those, and still others, indirect helpers, etc. He concludes that it seems impossible that any variation which may arise in a species in nature should not tend in some way or other, either to be a little better or worse than the previous stock. Even after half a century, Darwin's point about variations was still being defended with imaginary illustrations and attacked for being imaginary. The whole question of the struggle for existence has been discussed very largely from the a priori standpoint. Throughout the whole period since the appearance of The Origin of Species, wrote the geneticist Raymond Pearl in 1911, the rabbit with his legs a little longer, the fox with a little keener sense of smell, the bird of dull colors which harmonize with the background, et id genus omne, have been made to do valiant service. Darwin himself never tried to produce experimental confirmation of this particular point. It is at once extremely logical and extremely hard work to prove. Certainly, he could not prove his case with his finches. He never learned much more about the details of their struggle for existence than he did during that first glimpse on San Cristobal, when he watched the birds hopping together under the bushes, scratching in the cindery soil with their powerful beaks and claws. If anything, those mixed flocks argued against his case. He saw finches with long, thin beaks and short, fat, parrot-like beaks, all hopping on the same lava, eating identical bird food. If beaks with such widely different shapes could handle and crack the same seeds, then what could it possibly matter if, among the parrot-beaked finches, one bird's beak was a little fatter than another's, or if, among the sharp-beaked finches, one was a little sharper? On Daphne Major, for instance, the beak of the average Magnirostris is 14, 15, and 16 millimeters in width, length, and depth. The beak of the average Fuliginosa on Daphne is only about 7, 8, and 7 millimeters. That is, less than half as big. Yet Darwin saw both species eating the same food. If those two tools can do the same work, then what is the point of the Grant's measurements of two neighboring cactus finches, one with a beak 14.9, 8.8, and 8 millimeters, and the other 15.8, 9.7, and 9 millimeters? Variations that small would seem to mean nothing. Natural selection is supposed to scrutinize the slightest variations in nature, daily and hourly. But as far as Darwin could say after his 5 weeks in the Galapagos, natural selection is blind to the beak of the finch. No wonder he left them out of the origin. An ornithologist named Osbert Salvin looked over some museum specimens of Galapagos finches in the 1870s, 4 decades after Darwin collected them. It was Salvin who noticed how variable the finches can be, one from the next, in the length of their legs, in their wingspans and their weights, and especially in their beaks. Salvin felt the Galapagos was classic ground, even in the 1870s. Having discovered that the island's finches represent an extraordinary range of variations, he must have been disappointed that these variations seemed to have so little influence on the survival of the fittest. "The members of this genus," he wrote, "present a field where natural selection has acted with far less rigidity than is usually observable." Of course, the action of natural selection had never been observed at all. Like Darwin, most of the series of scientific pilgrims who made their way to Darwin's islands arrived in the wet season, or what passes for a wet season in these desert islands. All of the bushes and trees were in leaf and flower, and there were plenty of seeds on the ground. The scientists watched closely, and they saw exactly what Darwin had seen. Most of the ground finches were hunting and pecking together beneath the half-naked bushes. All those different beaks were cracking the same birdseed. One after another, this series of careful ornithologists concluded that the shape of the beak of a ground finch makes no detectable difference in the food it eats. "To look at the bills of these birds in the hand, we would conjecture wholly different diets," wrote the biologist and explorer William Beebe, who sailed out to Daphne Major through clouds of yellow butterflies in the wet season of 1923. "The small, delicate mandibles of Fuliginosa would seem adapted to insect food, or at least small, rather soft seeds," he said. "At the other extreme, the huge beak of Magnirostris, almost as large as the entire head, would be equal to the hardest of acorns." But both birds were eating identical foods. What a mad country for birds and butterflies! It seems unbelievable now, but the action of natural selection is so easy to miss that Darwin's finches were considered by generations of ornithologists to be an exception, or even a counter-illustration, to Darwinism. In 1935, the 100th anniversary of Darwin's visit to the islands, the ornithologist Percy R. Lowe gave a commemorative lecture before the British Association on the birds of the Galapagos. Lowe confined his talk to the Galapagos finches. He called them, apparently for the first time, Darwin's finches. But having read the by now extensive literature, Lowe declared his belief that the birds are not separate species at all, but hybrid swarms. He thought their extraordinary variations would prove to be as meaningless as the varieties of coats in the stray mutts and cats in an alley. The beak of the finch offered no scope for natural selection. "Yes, he really said that, didn't he?" Peter Grant says now. "No scope for natural selection. which was a wonderful way of stimulating people to go out and try to disprove him. 3 years later, another British ornithologist anchored off San Cristobal, Darwin's first island. Like Darwin, he was a young man in his 20s. Lowe's lecture had piqued his interest, and although the Galapagos Islands had seemed impossibly remote, he had been encouraged to make the trip by Julian Huxley, a grandson of Darwin's bulldog. David Lack stayed through almost all of the wet season, one of the wettest wet seasons in the Galapagos in this century. The wet season is the finch's breeding season, and Lack saw a lot of breeding. He saw that the 13 species of finches in the islands rarely interbreed. He even built aviaries in the long, hot, humid afternoons and tried to get the birds to hybridize inside them, but they would not cooperate. They seemed to be very particular in choosing their mates, so Lowe had been wrong to call them hybrid swarms. Still, even though the birds were not breeding together, most of the ground finches were feeding together, eating the same seeds. Lack had to agree with Lowe that the beak of the finch offers no scope for natural selection. In fact, Lack concluded, there is no evidence whatever in any of the island forms of Geospizinae, Darwin's ground finches, that their differences have adaptive significance. He wrote up this result in a monograph, but its publication was delayed by the outbreak of World War II. It was some time after Lack got home to England that, like Darwin before him, he did a double take. As he looked over his data, he noticed that the species of finches whose beaks are most nearly identical do not live together on any of the islands in the archipelago. The cactus finch, Geospiza scandens, breeds on Daphne Major, for example, and also on all of the biggest islands in the archipelago except Fernandina. The large cactus finch, Geospiza conirostris, breeds on Genovesa and Española. Lack had never seen breeding colonies of both cactus finches on any one island. What is more, if two finch species with rather similar beaks do share an island, their beaks are more divergent in their measurements on that island than they are elsewhere. That is, the longer beak is longer than average, and the shorter beak is shorter than average, almost as if they were consciously trying to get out of each other's niches. Lack found these patterns in case after case, not only in his own data books, but also in measurements of the thousands of museum specimens that had been collected since Darwin. Like Darwin, he could not see evolution in action, and he assumed it would be too slow to watch. But he could infer, looking back at the Galapagos, that something must be going on. Lack was influenced in part by other biologists' studies of microcosms smaller than the Galapagos. Place two different species of Paramecium in a test tube, and come back in a few days. One species will have conquered the top of the test tube, and the other owns the bottom of the test tube, and the border in the middle is a no-cells land. Likewise with barnacles. One species takes the high tide line, and another takes the low tide line. Such experiments seem to show that no two species eating the identical foods in identical ways can coexist peaceably in the same test tubes, on the same rocks, or on the same islands without one species driving the other to extinction. This is just the sort of competition and conflict that Darwin had imagined might lead to the extinctions of many branches and twigs on the tree of life. The branches in the middle would die off, and the survivors would bend and twist and diverge to either side, as if to minimize competition by making themselves as different as possible. Lack made charts of the beaks and their distributions in the archipelago. On island after island, Darwin's process seemed to him to have exterminated one or the other of two like-beaked species, or else to have pushed the survivors far enough apart to coexist. Whenever species with very similar beaks try to colonize the same island, Lack decided, they are thrown into competition. The struggle grows so bitter that one or the other species of finch is driven to extinction. But occasionally, two like-beaked species evolve enough local differences that the intensity of their competition is reduced. Then both species survive. Lack turned a classic negative case into a classic positive case, and helped to end the eclipse of Darwinism. In 1947, the very title of his monograph, Darwin's Finches, had a triumphant ring to it. Darwin's finches really are Darwin's. There is scope for natural selection in the beak of the finch. The book had a powerful influence on specialists and on the general public, even though Lack had not actually seen natural selection in action any more than Darwin had. During their first field season in 1973, the Grants and the Abbotts measured not only finch beaks but also finch behavior. They staked out 8 sites of 23,000 square meters. At each site, they marked off a grid of reference points by tying red flagging tape to hundreds of cactus bushes and torchwood trees. Each morning, they would crisscross one of the grids with binoculars, notebooks, and stopwatches and see what the finches ate for breakfast. The Grant team discovered that the ground finches were concentrating on about 2 dozen different species of seeds. So the members of the team put each of these 2 dozen kinds of seeds between the points of a vernier calipers and measured them as carefully as they measured the birds' beaks. They also measured the seeds' hardness with the McGill Nutcracker. This is a gadget that Peter Grant designed with the help of an engineer at McGill University in Montreal, his first teaching post. The McGill Nutcracker is a pliers with a scale attached. Squeeze a seed with the pliers, and the scale shows how much force it takes to crack the seed open. Modern physicists measure force in a unit they named for the founding father of their science, the Newton. To crack a grass seed, which is a speck about the size of a poppy seed, takes very little force, less than 10 newtons. A big cactus seed, the size of a peppercorn, takes more than 50 newtons. Cracking the toughest seeds in the Galapagos requires a force of 250 newtons, which is enough force to lift more than 1,000 cactus finches into the air. Peter Grant combined the measurements of seed size and seed hardness and rated each kind of bird seed as the finches might themselves in a sort of struggle index. The small, soft ones of Portulaca score the lowest on this index, only 0.35. The big, hard seeds of Cordia lutea score highest, almost 14. Any of the finches can handle Portulaca in its beak, but very few are up to Cordia. The Grant team also kept a census of the numbers of each kind of seed on the lava. To do this objectively, they used a random number table to select a single plot of lava, 1 meter square, somewhere in each grid. Then they counted every single fruit and seed they could find on that square of lava, whether it was dangling from the top of a cactus tree or lying in the middle of a cactus patch. Next, they chose a much smaller plot within that square meter, again at random, and they sifted the hot, cindery soil, collecting every fruit and every seed they found. Finally, they withdrew to their tents and spread out their trophies on white trays to count one by one. And they repeated the whole routine 50 times. "Most miserable piece of data we did," said Peter Boag, who with his wife, Laureen Radcliffe, joined the Grant group early on. "Sift the dirt," groans Radcliffe. "Count every seed, every single seed. That's Portulaca, that's Rincosia, that's Sitaria, Acalypha, Mentzelia, Heliotropium, Ark!" "People think fieldwork is so romantic," Boag says. "But a lot of it is real slog. This was absolutely the worst." They got to know the Galapagos birdseed so well that they could recognize the main species at a glance. They could often recognize a seed as it shattered in the tip of a finch's beak. "That's one advantage of the Galapagos," Boag says now. "You know exactly what the birds are getting. That's why we all want to work there, not because it's nice, because it's simple." In most parts of the world, one might find 200 species of plants in a single spadeful of earth. It would be impossible to find out exactly what a flock of birds is getting in its beaks, as they move by the hour from lawns to woods to meadows to the banks of a stream. But on Daphne Major, the finch watchers could get almost a god's-eye view of their flocks, which never went anywhere and never migrated for the winter. "And of course, when the watchers unrolled their mist nets," adds Radcliffe, "every bird you caught was a finch." No one anywhere has duplicated the kind of field work we did in the Galapagos because it was so simple, Boag says. "Those ecosystems are stripped to the bare bones." By the end of their first stay in the islands, the members of the finch unit thought they knew the finches' tastes in seeds, fruits, insects, leaves, buds, and flowers. On Daphne Major alone, the team had watched and made notes while medium ground finches ate 4,000 meals. They knew exactly what the finches were eating, and they knew the size and shape of the beaks the finches were eating them with. And most of the ground finches were eating the same seeds and fruits, just as Darwin had seen in his first glance on San Cristobal. Before Peter Grant left the islands, the acting director of the Charles Darwin Research Station, Jitte de Vries, gave him some advice. He reminded Peter that in the Galapagos, the first half of each year is wet and the second half is dry. The Grant team, like Darwin, Beebe, Lack, and all the rest, had visited the birds in the wet season. But the dry season might be the time to watch life squeeze Darwin's finches. Darwin's process can be hard for us to spot when nature is flush, when we behold the contented face of a bright landscape or a tropical forest glowing with life, as Darwin writes in Natural Selection. And at such periods, most of the inhabitants are probably living with no great danger hanging over them, and often with a superabundance of food. Nevertheless, the doctrine that all nature is at war is most true. The struggle very often falls on the egg and seed, or on the seedling, larva, and young. But fall it must sometime in the life of each individual, or more commonly, at intervals on successive generations, and then with extreme severity. The Grants came back a few months later. Even from the air, they could see the difference as they flew into the small airport on the island of Baltra, built by the United States 6th Air Force during World War II, and maintained now by the Ecuadorian Air Force. Everywhere the lava was brown, black, red, almost no green below the highlands of Santa Cruz. At the research station, de Vries told them that there had been no rain at all at the station in the months of April, May, June, and July. The Grant team recaptured many of the birds they had caught during their first trip and dangled them again in the spring balance. The finches had lost weight, and when the members of the team counted the seeds on the same plots as before, they could see why the birds might be hungry. There was not much bird food on the ground anymore. The plants had dropped all their leaves and seeds and had stopped making new ones, and the birds had eaten so many of the old seeds that their platter was almost clean. At the study site on the island of Genovesa, the volume of finch food was down by 84%. Not only was there less food for the finches, there was also less variety. Only about half of their favorite kinds of food were left. And in the wet season, most of the seeds on the ground had been so small and soft that the average seed had rated only 0.5 on the struggle index. The seeds that remained were mostly big and tough, and the average was higher than 6. In the wet season, every ground finch had the same favorite menu, 7 kinds of soft seeds and fruits. Each ground finch had spent about half its foraging time on those 7. But now the ground finches spent only about 1/30 of their time on them. Magnirostris has the biggest beak and the most powerful jaw muscles of any of the finches. It is the only finch that is strong enough to break and rip off the Grant's metal bands from its ankles. Magnirostris was now concentrating on big, heavy seeds, the seeds that almost none of the other finches can crack. The long, thin beak of the cactus finch is another of the most distinctive-looking beaks among the ground finches. Cactus finches were now taking advantage of their beak's special talents and dining almost exclusively on cactus seeds. It was the same with all 6 of the ground finches. Now that they were reduced to tough foods, the birds' toolkit beaks were determining what the birds ate. They had become specialists, and each bird's specialty was set by the shape of its beak. Smaller, local variations were making a difference, too. The Grants can often tell which island a finch comes from just by glancing at it. Fortis on Daphne, for instance, is smaller than Fortis on Santa Cruz, even though the islands are in plain sight of each other and within flying range for the finches. Meanwhile, cactus finches on Daphne have narrower, finer beaks than cactus finches on Santa Cruz. These variations from population to population are often much subtler than the variations between species, a matter of a millimeter or so. But they too make a mortal difference. They help determine what each population can do to get through the dry season. For example, the average length of a Fortis beak on the island of Pinta is slightly deeper than on Daphne Major. Torchwood stones on the two islands are almost identical in size and hardness, but on Daphne, Grant says he has seen some of the Fortis take as much as 6 minutes to crack open a single stone. That is a long time for a bird to struggle, and most of the time the bird just gives up after a while and drops the stone. On the island of Pinta, however, the Fortis, with their slightly deeper beaks, are much faster with torchwood stones, and 4 out of 5 Fortis can crack them. The difference in their beaks is only a millimeter. Among finches of the same species on the same island, individuals often vary by smaller amounts than that. Now we are down to the level of variation that Darwin himself argued is the cornerstone of evolution. Not even Lack ever suggested that differences this small can matter in the beak of the finch. But Peter Boag made a clear and simple test of their significance a little later in the watch on Daphne Major, after hundreds of Fortis had been banded. Boag walked around and around the island. Each time he spotted a Fortis with a band on its ankle, he watched the bird until he saw it pick up a seed, and he wrote down what kind of seed it was. Boag found that in the dry season, the birds with the biggest beaks eat the biggest seeds, the birds with medium-sized beaks eat medium-sized seeds, and the birds with the smallest beaks eat the smallest seeds. Another Goldilocks and the Three Bears result. One of the finch's most bitter struggles for existence is their running battle with a weed called caltrop. The Grants have made a case study of this. It is a classic demonstration of the war of nature, and in fact, caltrop's name is rooted in the fields of war. For more than 1,000 years, soldiers have sown battlefields with a certain kind of low-tech booby trap, spiky iron balls. Generally, each ball has 4 spikes, so that 1 spike always sticks up to caulk or cut a man's foot or a horse's leg. Roman charioteers threw caltrops behind them to prevent pursuit. Yankee pioneers sowed the grass outside their log cabins with smaller caltrops. Some called them iron stars when there were Indians around. Caltrop the plant also bears the Latin name of tribulus, from the same Latin root as tribulation, tribulare, to afflict or oppress. Like many other plants, including the star thistle and the water chestnut, caltrop defends its fruit with sharp spines. Each roundish fruit is divided into 6 sections, or mericarps, and as long as the fruit is still on the caltrop plant, each section holds the seeds inward to the center, with the sharp spines facing out. When the fruit dries, these mericarps fall one by one to the ground. There is a single row of seeds nestled inside each mericarp like peas in a pod. One mericarp holds as many as 6 large, nutritious, nutty-flavored kernels, each kernel in its own woody compartment, like chocolates wrapped in wooden foils inside a locked wooden box. A caltrop's mericarp can be awkward in a finch's beak, almost as awkward as an iron star beneath a human foot or a horse's hoof. In fact, 2 species of finches on Daphne Major, the cactus finch and the small ground finch, have never been seen to try to open them. The only species that do attack mericarps are the large and the medium ground finches, Magnirostris and Fortis, and each species has its own tactics. Magnirostris, whose beak is almost twice as wide and twice as deep as the beak of a Fortis, picks up a mericarp, holds it near the midpoint of its beak, and squeezes its mandibles together. After a while, the mericarp shatters into fragments. The Magnirostris picks up each fragment, holds it on one side of the beak, and crushes it. When a mag is working on a tribulus, Peter Grant says, I can hear it cracking. To crack a whole mericarp like this takes an average force of more than 200 newtons. Apparently, that is more force than a Fortis can muster. Instead, it braces the mericarp against the ground and bites and twists the woody sheet that guards the row of seeds, as if peeling off a lid. This operation requires about 54 newtons of force, which seems to be about the best a Fortis can do. Neither species has it easy, and Grant has seen birds of both species use a rock to help them. The finch holds the mericarp in its beak, braces the upper mandible against a rock, and squeezes the lower mandible closed on the seed while pressing the upper mandible against the rock. Now, Magnirostris, because it crushes the whole mericarp in its powerful beak, can eat every last seed before it moves on to another mericarp. But Fortis, with its smaller beak and weaker jaw, has to peel off the lid, exposing and eating one seed at a time. Typically, it eats only one or two seeds and then moves on. It almost always eats the seeds in the same order, too, starting at the narrow, pointed end of the maracarp and working toward the blunt end, as charmingly methodical as a child eating corn on the cob. Watching these birds combing the dry lava for tribulus seeds is like watching people hunt through a bowl of pistachio shells for the last unopened nuts, the ones that were thrown down before as too tough to crack. Birds of both species will often pick up a maracarp, work at it for a few seconds, sometimes longer, and then drop it and move on, like someone dropping a sealed pistachio nut back in the bowl. The finches prefer maracarps with only two spines, and maracarps with four spines are likely to be dropped. One indication that Magnirostris has an easier time than Fortis at eating caltrop, says Grant, is that a Magnirostris cracks many more maracarps than it rejects, while a Fortis rejects many more than it cracks. Darwinian competition is not only the clash of staghorns, the gore on the jaws of lions, nature red in tooth and claw. Competition can also be a silent race, side by side, for the last food on a desert island, where the competitors never fight one another, and the only sound of battle is the occasional crack of a tribulus seed. Finches are locked in the most deadly competition even when they feed together in flocks. When times are hard, their lives depend on how efficiently they can forage for food, how little energy they can expend in getting how much energy in return. They are hungry, they are thirsty, and they are trying to keep their budget in balance. And as poor Mr. Micawber used to say, annual income £20, annual expenditure 19.96, result happiness. Annual income £20, annual expenditure £20.06, result misery. The race is to the swift, and Magnirostris is clearly the winner. It can eat more than four seeds from two maracarps in less than a minute, while Fortis gets only three seeds from two maracarps in more than a minute and a half. In fact, Magnirostris gets about 2.5 times as much energy per minute, and because it gets more seeds out of each maracarp, it has to hop around less too, which also saves energy. Of course, Magnirostris is bigger than Fortis, not only in beak but in body size, so it needs more food. It needs 1.5 times as much energy to meet its minimum daily metabolic requirements. But since the big beak of Magnirostris earns the bird 2.5 times as much energy, it still comes out ahead. A few Fortis have found a trick that helps them even the score. One of them sometimes trails a Magnirostris around on the lava. As soon as the Magnirostris cracks a maracarp, Grant says, the Fortis rushes up, steals a piece, flies a little way off, and cracks it. Not every Fortis on Daphne seems to know this trick. The Grant team has spotted only about 6 of them doing it. Likewise, on Daphne Major, cactus finches sometimes open cactus buds, and Fortis has never been seen even trying to open them. But sometimes a Fortis will wait beside a cactus finch, scandens, and after the scandens has torn open the bud, the Fortis joins in. So the trials and tribulations of a caltrop are not only harder on Fortis than Magnirostris, they are harder on some Fortis than others. Fortis with bigger beaks can crack the maracarp and gouge out the seeds faster than those with smaller beaks. Tiny variations are everything. A Fortis with a beak 11 millimeters long can crack caltrop. A Fortis with a beak only 10.5 millimeters long will not even try. The smallest grain in the balance can decide who shall live and who shall die. Between a beak big enough to crack caltrop and a beak that can't, the difference is only 0.5 millimeter. Incidentally, the beak of the finch may be exerting selection pressure on the caltrop itself. The Grants have not made a careful study of this, but out of curiosity, Peter once compared the caltrop on the eastern rim of the crater, where there is heavy Fortis traffic, and the caltrop on the northwest inner wall of the crater, about 20 meters down from the rim, where Fortis rarely goes. Where there are many finches, each maracarp has fewer seeds, but it has longer and more numerous spines. In the steep, rugged, protected place, the maracarps have more seeds and fewer, shorter spines. Peter suspects that the caltrop is evolving in response to the finches. Where the struggle for existence is fierce, the caltrop that is likeliest to succeed is the plant that puts more energy into spines and less into seeds. But in the safer, more secluded spot, the fittest plants are the ones that put more energy into making seeds and less energy into protecting them. The finches may be driving the evolution of caltrop, while caltrop is driving the evolution of the finches. According to the greatest authority on plants of the Galapagos, Duncan Porter, this species of caltrop comes from Africa. It may have traveled across the Pacific from island to island on the boots, pantaloons, and hairy legs of sailors, whalers, and buccaneers. If that is how it reached the Galapagos, then the very earliest date for its arrival on Daphne Major is 1535, which is the year the first Europeans saw the Galapagos. It was the unlucky Fray Tomás de Berlanga, the third bishop of Panama, who was so glad to get away from the islands that afterward he did not even bother to name them. We will never know when the first tribulus seed reached Daphne Major. Probably it was not the year the good bishop collided with the islands, for he is unlikely to have seen Daphne Major or to have stopped there if he did. So the war of beaks and spines on this islet may very well have evolved in the brief space of a few centuries, since the first seabird landed on the crater floor with a caltrop stuck to its webbed foot, or since the first human being sailed around the island a few times and planted a boot on the welcome mat. "What a trifling difference must often determine which shall survive and which perish," Darwin wrote. To many of his critics, this has seemed pure conjecture. But after a good part of a lifetime on Daphne Major, the Grants find it obvious. "I often think of a piano playing," Rosemary Grant says. "I know I try to play the piano in spite of small hands, and how much easier it would be if my fingers were only a little longer. Or think of tweezers," she adds. Everyone in El Grupo Grant needs tweezers, because they collect cactus spines, especially during a nest census or a seed and fruit census, and some of Daphne Major's longest-suffering human inhabitants have come to consider tweezers the most indispensable item of Daphne equipment. A complete tweezers kit includes a slant tip, a square tip, and a pointed tip. Often you can use any one of them to do the job of another, but that makes clumsy work and takes a long time. "And what a small difference in shape and size there is between the different kinds," says Rosemary. The Grants see the importance of variations on display not only on Daphne Major, but throughout the archipelago. The second most closely watched island in their study is Genovesa, which the Grants began watching intensively in 1978. The work on Daphne is mostly Peter's, and the work on Genovesa is mostly Rosemary's. When they are alone, the Grants call Daphne Peter's Island and Genovesa Rosemary's Island. On Genovesa, Rosemary has focused on the cactus finch, Conirostris, a finch that Darwin never saw. These cactus finches, like their congeners on Daphne, all eat more or less the same food when the food is cheap. But in times of famine, they tend to specialize. Those with significantly longer beaks can hammer open the fruits of the cactus and probe the cactus flowers. Those with longer and deeper beaks can crack the big, tough cactus seeds. Those that have significantly deeper beaks than the others can strip the bark from the trees to get at the bugs underneath. It is one more demonstration that Darwin was right about the importance of slight variations. All this is precisely the kind of illustration that Darwin asks his readers to imagine in The Origin. Once we accept that slight variations can help decide who lives and who dies, Darwin takes his thesis a step further. He argues that favorable variations will be more likely to be passed down. They will spread through the population from one generation to the next, while variations that hurt individuals in the population will tend to dwindle and die out. During the eclipse of Darwinism, this point seemed as much a matter of faith as the rest of Darwin's theory. Believers accepted it, skeptics rejected it. In the 1930s, for instance, the British evolutionists Robson and Richards analyzed the handful of studies that purported to show evolution in action. Robson and Richards concluded that even where natural selection might just possibly have been detected in action, The case studies did not prove Darwin's point because, in the opinion of Robeson and Richards, the variations in question had not been passed down, and variations that are not passed down cannot lead to evolution. Peter Boag has a background in genetics. After the Grant team had been watching Daphne a few seasons, Boag decided, as part of his thesis project, to try to measure the relation of parent bill size to offspring bill size in Darwin's finches. That is, he would measure how accurately the variations in their beaks are passed down, a factor that matters as much to their evolution as the presence of the variations themselves, or their influence on the lives of the individual birds. Improbable as it sounds, no one had ever actually tried to measure this factor, known in the jargon of genetics as heritability in the wild. The more accurately the variations are reproduced, the more heritable they are. The faster the work of evolution could proceed among these finches. And without actually making the measurements, Peter Boag explains, we didn't have any basis to judge. Boag looked over all of the finch group's data, several years' worth, and he compared the sizes of the offspring and the sizes of their parents. He found that the body size of a finch does indeed depend very strongly on the size of its parents. A finch's size is highly heritable. Boag also compared the birds' beaks to their parents. The shape and size of the beak, too, is highly heritable. The beak of the finch is passed down faithfully from one generation to the next. There was one loose end that could invalidate Boag's results. Suppose, for the sake of argument, that on Daphne Major in those years, Fortis finches with bigger-than-average beaks were able to get more food. And suppose birds that eat better as babies grow up to be bigger-beaked adults. If so, a pair of big-beaked parents would have tended to provide more food for their babies, and their babies would have grown up big-beaked too. Big-beaked parents would have big-beaked offspring, small would have small, and yet the effect would have nothing to do with genetics. Despite the correlations that Boag had found, the size and shape of the beak of the finch might not be passed down from parent to chick. This was nothing more than the age-old question of nature versus nurture. And Boag knew how to test it. If he took some eggs from a pair of big finches and put them in the nest of a pair of small finches, would the young grow up looking like their true parents or their foster parents? Boag never did have a chance to perform this experiment during his watch on Daphne. And in retrospect, the finch watchers are glad he didn't, because their study is now so sensitive that the large numbers of egg switchings that Boag planned would have caused unnatural disruptions from that day to this. In fact, locally, Boag might have changed the course of evolution. Instead, the egg switch was performed by Jamie Smith after he left the Galapagos and set up shop among the sparrows on Mandart Island. Smith switched many eggs from one sparrow nest to another, just as Boag had planned to do on Daphne. He found that the foster birds took after their true parents, not their adoptive parents. Being raised by a larger bird does not make you a larger bird. The young birds resemble their true parents, even though they are not raised by their true parents. This is very strong evidence that it is nature, not nurture, that plays the larger role in deciding the size of the sparrows and the shape of their beaks. As with the finches, the sparrows' beak variations get passed down with remarkable fidelity, from one generation to the next. Recent studies have shown that even the smallest details of bird life, everything from the exact size of the eggs to the number of the eggs and the date they are laid, are heritable too, at least to some degree. They are passed down from generation to generation in species after species of birds. This seems to be the rule rather than the exception in nature, just as Darwin imagined it to be, although not all variations in the living world are passed down as faithfully as the beak of the finch. Originally, the Grants had planned to study Darwin's finches for a few months and lug home as much data as they could. Then they would try to sort out some of the forces that have made the birds what they are. In other words, the Grants were planning to take a snapshot. And if Darwin had been right about the slow pace of evolution, no one could ever take more than a snapshot. Watching these birds would be like watching the stars for an astronomer, or the mountains for a geologist. Even 100 years in the Galapagos would be a snapshot. But as the pieces fell into place, the Grants and their team began to understand that they had something worth watching. They would have to come back. The birds are exceptionally variable in their beaks. They are exceptionally sensitive to these variations. They pass on their variations with exceptional fidelity. Each of the requirements of Darwin's process, each of the prerequisites for evolution by natural selection, is heightened in Darwin's finches to an almost unnatural degree. "Slow but sure moves the might of the gods," says the chorus in Euripides' The Bacchae. "Slow but sure moves the power of natural selection," says Darwin. But here on Daphne Major, among Darwin's finches, the action might be swift and sure. No one had ever stood watch before among Darwin's finches, so the Grants could only wait and see. As things turned out, they did not have long to wait.